cheerful good morning to everyone. This is Roy Porter in the NBC newsroom in New York, and are we going on a news trip today? Weather permitting, we'll drop in on General Marshall in Paris, then hop to Berlin, where the rest of the diplomatic party is assembling. Washington will provide a roundup of international activities, including President Truman's speech today, then the elections in Japan, and finally, new hope from London. First, your announcer, then I'll be back with your world news roundup.
In two world wars, we were caught relatively unprepared. We can't afford that luxury a third time. Because of this and because of vast technological advances in modern warfare, our new United States Army is to be not only the largest, but the best trained and technically educated in our peacetime history. The enlisted man in today's regular army, whether in the infantry, the artillery, or the air corps, learns to acquire professional skills in handling specialized and complicated equipment. For radar, jet aircraft, or giant electronic calculators that predict with hair-trigger speed and precision the flight of high-speed projectiles. The new United States Army contributes to our national security and, through scientific research, to the arts of peacetime living. Now, back to the newsroom and the World News Roundup.
Bulletin news this morning. General Marshall has landed in Paris on his way to the Moscow conference. During a one-day stay, he will dine with President Vincent Auriol and confer with Premier Paul Ramadier. President Truman has left Mexico on his way to Waco, Texas, where he will deliver what Senator Tom Connally calls a notable address on important international questions that will attract worldwide attention and consideration. The president's speech will be heard over this network at 1 p.m. today, Eastern Standard Time. More trouble in Palestine. Jewish underground forces have attacked a British military camp again. This time, three British soldiers and two underground attackers were wounded. Trails of blood led away from the battle scene. In Paris, Auguste Champetier de Ribes, longtime political leader and French prosecutor at the Nuremberg trials, died of a heart attack. He was 64 and had only recently been elected president of the parliamentary body which corresponds to our Senate. The stockyards at St. Paul, Minnesota, are tied up in a strike of livestock handlers this morning and are refusing to accept any more animals. The strike is expected to spread to the packing plants. And good old Mount Etna, the Sicilian volcano, is belching lava again after 2 days of quiet. White-hot lava is flowing from two craters at the rate of 600 feet an hour. The French capital is welcoming our Secretary of State this morning on his way to the Moscow capital. For a direct report, here's Paul Archinard in Paris.
General Marshall, Secretary of State, arrived at Orly Airfield at 1:06 Paris time today, just 1 hour and 9 minutes ago. It's shortly after 2:00 in the afternoon here, and the Secretary of State is now stopping at the residence of United States Ambassador Jefferson Caffrey on the Avenue de Yéna. His plane was met by the ambassador and many French officials and members of the press, and he left the airport immediately in the ambassador's car. Whether he will give a press conference in the course of the day is not yet known. There was considerable bustle around the American embassy this morning, with people telephoning in continually to learn the secretary's plan. The foreign office in Paris, now that Monsieur Bido, foreign minister, has left for Moscow, is represented by the French delegate, Coupe de Merville, whose departure from Moscow was delayed by illness. There are, in the absence of Monsieur Bido, no plans for the secretary's visit as far as the foreign affairs are concerned, but tonight, Monsieur Vincent Auriol, president of France, is giving a dinner in honor of the American Secretary of State at his Palace of the Élysée residence. This overnight visit and reception at the presidential palace will give Secretary Marshall the opportunity of getting French views on the German problem, which is going to be discussed in Moscow. Although Monsieur Bido is an able representative for France in Moscow, French high officials are extremely anxious to add their impressions to the documentation that Secretary Marshall is seeking on the French point of view. Outstanding political leaders like Premier Ramadier, Léon Blum, who did much to advance the British alliance, will see him. And the acceptance of the Berns plan as basis for a four-power treaty against the rearmament of Germany is hoped for in Paris today. This is Paul Archinard in Paris.
After Paris, the American diplomatic delegation is scheduled to make the next stop in Berlin. Here's Henry Cassidy in Berlin.
Berlin is undergoing a new invasion this morning, this time by the diplomats on their way to Moscow to decide the fate of Germany. British Foreign Secretary Bevan went through last night on his special train, which is now trundling toward the border station of Brest-Litovsk. French Foreign Minister Bido is due here in about an hour on his train. Three American airplanes are coming in today, one of which I hope to take. Tomorrow, Secretary of State Marshall is expected on his plane, and by Monday, all these groups hope to meet in Moscow for the Council of Foreign Ministers. The outlook for the conference is the usual cautious, diplomatic view of uncertainty. While Secretary Marshall said yesterday that he doubted whether the ministers could complete a peace treaty for Germany, Secretary Bevin said he thought the conference would be successful, both of which mean the same thing because even agreement on the basic principles for a new Germany will be a success. Before they reach the conference table, the delegates are taking the opportunity from train and plane to look over the main subject of their discussion. And the sight is not a pretty one. Berlin today is a dead city, lying still under a fresh coat of snow that gives the ruins a clean, antique appearance, but cannot disguise the ugly reality of paralysis. In the year and a half since the end of the war, some of the rubble has been stacked up in neat piles, and on the ground floors of some of the more habitable buildings, the walls have been bricked up, and you even see window displays of a few handmade products. But overall, Berlin looks like the Colosseum in Rome, multiplied many times. This is Henry Cassidy in Berlin.
These are great days for policymaking, and today will be another one with President Truman's Texas speech. For a roundup on the international diplomatic situation, come in, Leif Eed, in Washington.
This morning, Washington's trying to find some hope in the international news, but it's a tough job. President Truman's Mexican visit is over. He's in the air now and due in Waco, Texas this morning. Today, he accepts a degree from Baylor University in an important address to be broadcast over NBC. Senator Tom Connally says the president's speech will be on important international questions that will attract worldwide attention and consideration. But Washington's not expecting any pronouncement on the Greek situation, nor on Andrei Gromyko's latest blast against the American plan for controlling the atom. The Greek policy is still in the making, deep in the inner chambers of the State Department. And as for the atom, the president's latest word is his comment that we've come to the destructive point. And his main concern is that unless we get permanent peace, civilization might perish. He said we don't want to be a passing civilization, neither the great Mexican government nor the United States of America. We want to continue. But that was before he'd heard of Gromyko's statement that Russia will never allow atomic inspectors to roam at will over the Soviet land, nor United Nations control of Russian factories. That unlimited control would mean unlimited interference in the internal economic life of nations. And also that the American plan is directed against the independence of other states, an attempt at world monopoly in atomic energy, which didn't raise any high hope here in Washington. And on top of that, the State Department says it sent another hot note to Moscow just before Secretary Marshall took off, a protest that the Russians are trying to kick over Hungary's non-communist government. The department is not handing out the text until word comes that the note's been delivered. The flaring international questions again is having a sobering effect on congressional leaders, especially in the House. Both Republican leader Halleck and Democratic leader Rayburn say they hope that during the tough Moscow conference, House members will take time out from their almost daily blasts against Russia. This is Leif Eed in Washington.
Democratic elections in occupied Japan are new to that formerly enemy nation, and they take careful planning. Tell us about it, George Thomas Folster in Tokyo.
Japan's Prime Minister Yoshida believes he can run in next month's election and win. Here is how Yoshida's political experts dope it out. The Japanese politicians figure that the present prime minister will win the huge rural vote because Japan's farmers and fishermen are getting rich under the present setup, and they don't want to see any change. The Japanese themselves call the farmers and fishermen the new yen millionaires of Japan. Yoshida's supporters also believe that the prime minister will get the old line vote because Yoshida is a loyal party man and comes from a long line of moneyed families. The big Japanese labor unions are selecting their own candidates to run in the coming general elections. These candidates will be sponsored by Japanese labor with full union backing. This virtually makes every labor union a political party. On the same day that the anti-Yoshida labor unions announced that they would run their own candidates, Yoshida's government announced that General MacArthur's purge directive of January 4, 1946 would be enlarged and extended so as to include all labor leaders. To be sure, some wartime labor leaders have already been purged. This new extension, however, will include many lower echelons and could even affect some of the boys upon whom the unions are pinning their hopes. In the meantime, the big anti-Yoshida committee is still busy. It is made up of the labor unions that banded together last December and held nationwide Down with Yoshida cabinet rallies. The anti-Yoshida rallies were sponsored by the socialists, or rather the left wing of the socialists. These socialists, or Social Democrats Party, as they call themselves in Japan, are split right down the middle. On one side are those who will play ball with the communists, and on the other, those who won't. Each faction of the Socialist Party will run its own candidate, thereby splitting the vote and throwing away several seats in the Diet and as many other official government jobs. As several observers put it, the Japanese Socialist Party is committing suicide. This is George Thomas Folster in Tokyo.
And finally, the weather in Britain has forced labor for the first time to put in night shifts. For the details, here's Ned Roberts in London.
England is digging herself out today after a two-day freak blizzard, which has completely disrupted communications and isolated hundreds of smaller towns. Since Tuesday afternoon, a howling east wind has brought snow, hail, rain, and snow again. The forecast for today is more of the same. The Royal Automobile Club has warned motorists that the storm has cut the country in half. Not a single highway linking northern and southern England remains open. Trains into London are running more than 12 hours behind schedule. In the industrial area of the Midlands, 20 branch line railroads are completely out of action. On the extreme south coast, the first snow melted under a torrential cloudburst. Rising rivers flooded towns and farmlands. In one Devonshire village, small boats were used to rescue six families from their homes when the water reached second-story level. The storm struck Wales with terrific ferocity. 33 coal mines were closed down when snow blocked the main shafts, and 75,000 miners were unable to work. 8 Welsh trains were stranded in heavy drifts on Tuesday night. Some of the passengers were trapped for 36 hours. Food, hot tea, and blankets were brought them by emergency crews. In the West Country, farmers worked throughout the night to dig sheep and cattle out of the snow. Many were frozen to death. The tallest story of the day comes from the village of Oxcombe in Lincolnshire. Down there, the drifts are as high as the telegraph poles. The villagers swear that they have seen jackrabbits jumping over the telephone wires. This is Ned Roberts in London.
Here's more global news. The death toll in religious rioting at Lahore in Punjab province, India, has risen to 32 since Tuesday. The British have ordered a 24-hour curfew. There's more news. I'll be back in a moment. Now, here's your announcer.
Have you checked your car lately? Tires, brakes, windshield wiper? Too many people are getting hurt on our streets and highways and auto smash-ups, many of which could have been prevented. The cars involved had been in first-class running condition. Of course, there's a little matter of care and common sense behind the wheel. Going too fast on slippery roads or trying to pass on a hill or curve on a two-lane road has sent many a driver to the hospital. If you want to help save a life and live longer yourself, keep within the legal speed limits, especially in winter weather. If you're not in a car, exercise caution in crossing streets. Don't try to cross against the traffic lights. Don't get off a bus and cross directly in front of it. See that the lights are with you and cross the streets only at intersections, not in the middle of the block. You owe it to yourself and your family to take responsibility for your own safety, behind the wheel or on foot. Do your part to prevent traffic and highway accidents. Now, back to the newsroom.
In Sydney, Australia, a former seaman reported that yesterday he saw a man who, he believes, is Martin Bormann, Hitler's first deputy during the closing days of the war. "I'll bet all the tea in China," said the sailor, "that the man I saw on the street was Bormann." The Georgia Supreme Court is getting ready to rule on who of the two governors is legally the state's chief executive. The decision is expected in a few days after oral arguments today. And telephone workers' strike has been postponed in Baltimore after the employees and the company have agreed to an extension of their present contract. And that's really a world news roundup this morning. I'll be back with you at this same time tomorrow. So until then, this is Roy Porter wishing you a very good morning from the NBC Newsroom in New York.
This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.